Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast, brought to you by the Fretboard Journal magazine. The Fretboard Journal is a quarterly print magazine celebrating guitar culture and guitar people. We interview great musicians, great luthiers, collectors, and more. Join us and subscribe at fretboardjournal.com. This is obviously our podcast, and I am Jason Verlinde, your host. And as part of my job here, and I'm really grateful that this is my job, I get to tell you all about cool stuff that I think you will love, that I know you haven't read about in any other magazine or heard about on any other podcast. We've broken all sorts of acts to you all. I hope you enjoy that. I hope that you appreciate that I'm not trying to force feed you all the usual tried and true guitar content. We're constantly trying to spotlight new people and new faces and new voices. And as I was scrolling through the internet the other day, I was stopped in my tracks when I was reading about a young guitar maker who is building acoustic flat top guitars at the ripe old age of 17. We've heard a lot about kids who, during the pandemic, did something amazing. Wyatt Ellis, the mandolin player, is one great example. He's already playing the Opry. He took up mandolin just a handful of years ago. Equally remarkable is the story you're going to hear today. Rasmus Zandvliet, an incredible young builder who has a story you won't want to miss. He decided to start building acoustic guitars. It started with a uke, and then he moved into guitars. And I find this noteworthy for a variety of reasons. Acoustic guitars are notoriously difficult to build properly, and even if you were to start out with a kit, it requires a fair amount of tooling and expertise and time to build such a thing. Rasmus is in a place where there's very limited guitar luthery culture as well, so he's kind of learning off of the internet. It's an incredible story, and I would not have known about it had it not been for Jeremy Shepard, the guy who goes by Jeremy the Guitar Hunter on Instagram. He posted about getting one of Rasmus's guitars, and Jeremy has seen a fair share of guitars in his day, like 5,000. So for Jeremy to sing Rasmus's praises says a lot. And for Rasmus, who at the age of 17 and with very little fanfare is just decided to become a luthier and change his life's course, it's an amazing story. I hope you enjoy it. I want to get Rasmus in the pages of our magazine as well and document his career as it moves forward. So this is a two-part episode. First, we're going to hear from Rasmus about how he got into guitar building. Maybe it will inspire others out there. Maybe there are other Rasmuses out there. I don't know. Building acoustic guitars as a teenager, that requires a fair amount of bandwidth and attention that I just know I didn't have when I was 17. And then the second half of this interview is us talking to Jeremy the Guitar Hunter, Jeremy Shepard, about his career wheeling and dealing in guitars, his services that he's offering for guitarists who maybe want to build out their collection, what he thought of Rasmus's guitar that he received, and a lot more. We cover a lot of ground in this episode of the Fretboard Journal podcast. So first, we're going to turn you on to a really young builder that you're all going to want to go follow. And then second, we're going to talk to Jeremy the Guitar Hunter, one of the great guitar YouTube personalities in our little universe. I hope you enjoy it. As always, our podcast is brought to you by a few brands that care about what we're doing and support us, and we want to support them back. Peghead Nation, the incredible guitar, mandolin, and banjo instruction portal with some of my favorite instructors around. They're giving you your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription with the discount code Fretboard when you check out. Isotope are offering you all 10% off of their incredible software with the discount code Fret10. Stringjoy Strings, out of Nashville, they've become one of the fastest growing string companies around for good reason. They make guitar and mandolin strings now. They're offering you 10% off your first order with the discount code Fretboard. And our friends at Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar here in Seattle are sponsoring the podcast once again. An incredible vintage and boutique instrument store with a stellar repair center right here in Seattle, Washington. Follow them on Instagram, follow them on Reverb, follow them on YouTube, see what all the fuss is about, and then come say hi to them if you ever get the chance. You won't be disappointed. All right, first off, we are going to talk to our new friend, Rasmus, and I'll include a link to his Instagram in the show notes so you can see where he's at with his guitar building and get a little context for what we're talking about here during this chat. Rasmus, I discovered you probably like a fair number of people did off Instagram and Jeremy the Guitar Hunter posting about you. I usually don't speak to builders at the very beginning of their career, and I don't even know if this is going to be your career, but you are 17?
Correct, yeah.
And at least a couple guitars under your belt?
The one that I made for Jeremy was my second guitar, and working on the third one right now.
It looks almost done.
Getting there. I mean, yeah. Some more polishing, whatever else. Still needs a bridge.
Okay. So begs the question, how did you get into this little world?
Well, when I was, I believe, 14 or 15, I wanted to build a ukulele. So I got some wood and I started thicknessing it by sanding it, but that didn't work, of course. I tried to bend the sides, went horribly wrong. But anyway, after that, I like working with wood, and I was like, sure, why not? Let's spend some big bucks on getting some nice woods for an actual guitar. Because I, at that time, I did play a little guitar. I'm not a great guitar player by any means, but yeah, I got some woods for the first guitar I ever built. This one.
Yeah. Lovely.
I believe I made this when I was 15 and finished it when I was 16. And after that, I liked making guitars, or I liked making this guitar. So I was like, why not build another one? That's how that got started.
Have you grown up in a house where woodworking is a thing? Is your dad in the music? Like, how did you even stumble upon I could build my own ukulele?
Well, I saw some people on YouTube building guitars and ukuleles. And I thought, yeah, that looks fun. I want to do that. But yeah, my parents aren't woodworkers. They're both artists, like painters. But yeah, I've always been pretty handy with my hands. So I was like, why not give it a shot? So, mm-hmm. Seems fun.
So for that, it sounds like the first ukulele was a little trial and error. The guitar that you're holding, though, what did you turn to get help? Like, did you go off of plans? Did you just devour Stumac, or what did you do?
Well, I bought some plans off of Stumac, of course. And I watched a lot of YouTube videos, many, many hours of YouTube videos. And from that, I learned a little bit. And after that, more trial and error. I had to redo some things on it, but it turned out pretty good. Bent the sides with like a curling iron for your hair.
Really? Is that a well-known hack? No. Okay.
Usually people have a hot pipe that, a hot pipe with like a torch running through it, and they need to get to like 220 Celsius to bend the wood. And it was like, yeah, well, this curling iron does the same thing. So why not try it? And it worked pretty well. Still use it to this day, actually.
Did you just put in a vise or something?
I put it in my work vise. You're actually on my work table right now, but yeah, just put it in a vise and wet the wood a little bit, slowly bend it to the right shape.
You're in the Netherlands?
Correct, yeah.
Not known, I don't think, as being, there's not a ton of luthery going on there that I know of, in the guitar world at least.
Not a lot, no. There are some other guitar builders around here, but not too well known.
Yeah.
I did do an internship at an electric bass builder about a year ago. So I learned a lot there.
So are you still in the States here? It'd be high school. Are you still in school?
I'm in a trade school right now for cabinetry.
And what tell us about how that works. Cause like, I think that we don't really have trade schools like that here.
Well, when you're done with middle school, you can choose to study further, or you can go to what they call an MBO. I don't know what that is in English.
Yeah.
It's a vocational school for trades usually. And I decided to go to a woodworking school, so cabinetry. It's usually 3 to 4 years long. And you learn the basics of whatever trade you would like to learn. I went there because I built a guitar. I was like, yeah, I like working with wood, so why not give it a shot?
Yeah.
I'm in my second year right now.
Okay.
After this, I will stop with this school. I'll go to the International Luthery School in Belgium. That's exciting.
I don't know about that either. Tell us about that.
In Belgium, there's another system that I don't quite understand, but they have a Luthery school there. It's called ILSA, International School of Luthery in Antwerp. It's 3 years long. They basically learn you to build plucked instruments or violin family instruments. I chose for plucked instruments. So that's 3 years. And after that, you have an optional year of restoration, which I'm very excited about. Would love to get into restoring guitars.
Yeah. I mean, as a teenager in the Netherlands, are you exposed? Do you see many like pre-war or not even pre-war? Like, do you see any vintage Martins and Gibsons and all these guitars that you're probably trying to emulate
impossible
in some way?
Yeah, they're impossible to even hold. Yeah. I do have a vintage Gibson mandolin that I restored a while back. It's a Gibson A1 from 41. But it's very hard to get nice vintage instruments around here.
So what was your guitar before you built one for yourself?
It was a super crappy old laminate.
Okay.
An import dreadnought.
So at least you've built yourself a nice guitar.
I wanted a nice guitar. Or I was going to buy a Mexican-made Martin.
Yeah.
Or I was going to build one myself. And I decided to build one myself.
Incredible. How did Jeremy find you?
I was a watcher of Jeremy's videos, and we got in contact through the live shows and became friends. And I offered to build him a guitar, and he was into that. So that's how we got to know each other.
It's so cool. I mean, I know from your Instagram that, you know, you have a lot of the same music tastes that I do, and that a lot of, I think, probably Fretboard Journal readers do. Do you feel with the internet and Instagram and YouTube's at least a little connected to the guitar community? It's got to feel good.
Yeah. I mean, if there wasn't internet, I probably wouldn't be building guitars.
Yeah.
Let's put it.
And so I see a guitar plan hanging on the wall behind you. What exactly does your setup look like these days? Like how many do you have as many tools as you need? Are you constantly buying tools? Like, where are you at?
Well, I can show you my wall of tools. You'd like that. This is currently some of my tools, mostly hand tools, but you don't need a lot of tools to build a guitar. You really don't. I started out using about two chisels, a curling iron, and some sandpaper, more or less.
What do your parents think of this?
They're into it. Yeah, they like that I'm actually doing something and not behind a computer all day.
Yeah, that. Do you have specific luthiers that you admire, you want to meet, that you follow, that you kind of model yourself after?
Yeah, I mean, Henderson is a big one. I really like what he does. He's very good at what he does still. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you seen one?
In real life? No. Yeah. No, they're not around here.
You got to come to the Fretboard Summit in August. We'll introduce you to him.
You will be there. Well, maybe.
Who else? I mean, because Wayne is amazing, but keeps a pretty low internet profile. I'm sure there's some folks who are sharing a lot of information online that you're following.
Let me think. I mean, AJ Henderson also.
Mm-hmm.
She has great instruments. Thompson, PK Thompson guitars.
Mm-hmm.
Mark from Folkwave Music.
Also Mark Stutman, yeah.
Mark Stutman, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great information. I get most of my information from him, even just watching the few videos he has. Yeah, it's always great. Let me think, anyone else? That's pretty much it.
So you are committed to, you're going to cabinetry school now, and then you're going to go to the Lutheran school. How far is that from you, Belgium, from where you are?
It's about an hour by train, so not that far. We have a pretty good connection between our countries, so that's not too far away.
So will you commute, or are you going to move there?
I'm going to move there. I'm going to find a room and just live there for 4 years or maybe 8. We'll see.
Wow. Big adventure.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited.
So you're committed. Yeah, this is it. You're going to be a guitar maker, it sounds like.
Yeah. Guitar maker, restorer. We'll see. I'm not quite sure yet.
Have you met any guitar? I know you said that very limited, but are there any acoustic guitar makers in the Netherlands that you've been able to meet?
There are a few, but I have not met them personally. No. I mean, I believe there is one here in Rotterdam, but I haven't got in touch with them.
Yeah. So you're on guitar number 3 now. I know Jeremy's got quite a following and he's been plugging you. Do you have people reaching out, trying to order from you already?
Well, yesterday I had a couple people reach out to me, so that's very fun. I had I called one of them and he wanted like a single O 12 fret with mahogany and spruce. So that'll probably be my next build. So that's exciting. A commissioned guitar.
How do you even know how to charge for it? How did you figure that out?
I don't. I'm still not quite sure. Yeah.
Was this a project, it must have been, that sort of helped you get through the pandemic and the lockdown?
Yeah, it was very much a pandemic project. I started a little bit before the pandemic, and after it hit, I had a lot more time to work on it. So that helped. Otherwise, I probably would still be building that first guitar.
It's so cool. And are you starting to stockpile tone woods and like think about long-term stuff like that?
Yeah, I have some stuff I can show you.
Sure.
This is some old growth rosewood. I got this one with like a big plank. I had to get it re-sawn. Some mahogany. I bought like a lot of old Danish chair parts on a local marketplace it was old Brazilian rosewood, like 23 kilograms of it for like 60 euros, nothing.
Do you have access to a planer or a way to kind of get this down to guitar shaped wood?
At the cabinetry school I'm at, they have a lot of very, very nice equipment. So I was able to make this whole guitar from scratch. Didn't have to get it. I could thickness it there and just make it all happen, which is very, very nice. But you can get very far with just a block plane. Most of the work is done with a block plane.
So cool. Did you find Wayne Henderson through the book, Clapton's Guitar, or some other way?
No, I found I was very into bluegrass when I built my first guitar.
Yeah.
And I was listening to Molly Tuttle and Billy Strings, the newer bluegrass artists, Tony Rice. And I saw, I believe it was Molly playing a Henderson D45 on Carter Vintage.
Yeah.
On YouTube. And I really liked the guitar he built. So I did some more research on him, and it turned out he's a pretty good builder.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is, for sure. I'm just in awe of, you know, you're only 17 and you're, I don't know of any other 17-year-olds who are building acoustic guitars or even have built a few already. Like, this is incredible.
Thank you.
I mean, maybe have you met anyone online who's like about your same age and kind of in the midst of it? No.
No, No, everyone I've met online that builds guitars is in their 30s or 40s or 50s.
Okay. Wow. So you should come to the States at some point, whether or not you come to the Fretboard Summit that we throw. Like, you'd need to meet some luthiers.
Yeah, that would be fun. I'd be into that.
Do you have any interest in building electrics, or is it just all acoustics?
No, I'm not a big fan of electrics. I don't find them as compelling. I don't play electric. So there's something about acoustic guitars. It's just wood and strings, a little bit of metal, and it just works. You don't need any electricity or amps or just a guitar.
And is this workshop you have, was this just in your house?
This is a little small room in my house. This used to be a walkway.
Okay.
I live in a very old house, so the way everything is structured is very odd. It has been restructured multiple times. It's a house from like the mid-1800s.
Okay.
And this is just a little room. It's not big. It's like 2 by 4 meters, but it gets the job done. I don't need a lot of room.
Yeah. I mean, it looks very clean. It doesn't look like it's like coated in sawdust.
Well, sometimes it is. Most of the time. I just clean it up.
Well, and it sounds like you get to use the school a little bit for some of the dirtier jobs.
For the thickness sanding of the body, like the top, the back and the sides, and cutting the neck out with a bandsaw. It's very nice to have professional equipment. But yeah, the shaping of the neck, the final sanding, the polishing. I do that all in this shop here just because it doesn't create that much dust or grime, so to speak.
Have you turned any of your classmates on to the art of guitar making? And is anyone else interested in it?
Oh, one of my friends, he's looking into building a guitar now too. So that's fun. He wants to build like a 0012 fret. So I'm probably going to help him out with that and let him use my shop a little bit.
So remind me, the guitar you built for Jeremy, the guitar you built for yourself, that was like a D35 kind of thing going on, right?
Yeah, HD35 with African Padauk for the back and sides and Adirondack for the top.
The one for Jeremy was?
It's a 0018 12 fret with mahogany and European Alpine spruce, I believe.
Yeah. And is there one model of guitar that you're really hoping to build soon, but you haven't yet?
Ooh, that's a difficult question. There are a lot of guitars I want to build. Probably like a 0012 fret with Brazilian back and sides and some mother of pearl.
Yeah. I mean, is there even a high-end guitar store in your area where you can go and try out like the new versions of these from Martin or anyone else?
We have the Fellowship of Acoustics,
mm-hmm.
relatively close. They have some very nice instruments there. And there are also some smaller shops, but most of them don't carry Martins, especially the D35s or D45s. They don't have those.
Yeah.
Too expensive to import most of the time.
Does the Fellowship of Acoustics know about you?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay. I mean, when it comes to you, we were talking about Tonewoods. Do you have to buy them all from the States, even though they probably came from around the world? Or do you have a way to buy those?
I there is one Tonewood reseller in Portugal that has a lot of mahogany, rosewoods, Padauk, spruces. So I usually buy from them. They have, that way I don't have to pay import rights on. But yeah, sometimes I do have to buy from the States, like the Adirondack spruce or neck blanks, sometimes fingerboards, most of the time come from the States because Mac, LMI, most of the big resellers are located near to you.
Yeah. And tooling wise, are you're happy with what you have now, or is there like a tool that you want to get next?
always tools I want to get. I just bought this little Lee Nielsen plane. If, I don't know if you're into tools, but...
I don't know. I'm not a guitar maker. I just write about them all the time and interview them on this podcast.
Well, they're always tools I want to get. I mean, hand tools mostly, like Lee Nielsen stuff, Veritas, planes, saws, scrapers, you name it. I probably have it on my list.
It's incredible. But you're keeping the curling iron for now.
Maybe I'll get a proper bending iron, but I don't know. We'll see.
To spray, do you spray the sides with like something to humidify them a bit before you put them on the curling iron, or how are you doing it?
Yeah, I spray them with water.
Yeah.
Just so they're completely coated. I usually let them sit for about 30 minutes and then spray them again and then start bending them slowly. Just having like a mold similar to this as reference. Just getting it as close as possible and then just putting them in the mold with some clamps on it to let them dry out and stabilize, so to speak.
Yeah. Rasmus, I'm just in awe. Like, this is incredible. Are you playing music still?
I play a little bit of guitar, but I'm not a great player.
What are your interests outside of guitar?
Not a lot of interest outside of guitar. Mostly just building them and playing them. That's as far as my interests go.
Yeah. Did you have thoughts about what you would be when you were older before you decided to make that ukulele?
No, not really. I never really thought about it much, but building guitars came naturally and it was like, oh, why not? Why not give it a shot? Maybe I'll like doing it for a couple of years. Maybe I'll change roots after that.
You speak English really well. Does everyone in the Netherlands speak English as well as you do?
Most folks do. Yeah.
Okay.
Because Dutch is just not really used. It's used in Holland, but there are not a lot of people outside Holland that speak Dutch. So we adapt the most versatile language, which is English for the most part. English or German. Yeah.
And are you in the city or where are you in relation to the Netherlands?
I'm in Rotterdam. Mm-hmm. So quite a big city. I'm pretty central, but not in the center. So it's pretty quiet and peaceful. That's nice.
Yeah. I'm just floored. It's so cool to hear somebody so passionate about guitar. So I'm excited to see where you go with it.
Yeah. Thank you.
If anybody wants to follow you, do you have a website for your instruments yet or just Instagram?
At the moment, just Instagram. Yeah. Okay.
I'll include a link to that for folks who want to follow you. I hope you can make it to the States at some point because there's such a wealth of, an embarrassment of riches here when it comes to luthery and people you should meet. And I can't wait to see where you go. You're the youngest luthier I know.
Yeah, I'd love to meet you sometime.
All right, that was my chat with Rasmus. I did invite him to our Fretboard Summit in Chicago this August, so don't tell me that I should. I already did, and if he ever can make it this year or any future year, Rasmus, you have an open invite. Now we're going to talk to Jeremy the Guitar Hunter about his crazy life, which is amazing. Flipping guitars from an early age, finding your wheelhouse as sort of a guitar concierge for folks who want to get into this world of buying guitars or selling guitars and not really knowing how to do it. Now he's got a brick and mortar store he's helped shepherding along. It's an incredible story. Here is my chat with Jeremy Shepherd. Jeremy, the Guitar Hunter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you based?
I'm in Harrisonburg, Virginia, in the widest part of the Shenandoah Valley.
Okay. I've been following you for a long time, and I love the scope, the range of, you know, you're helping people buy and sell guitars, but it's not just, cheap guitars or vintage electrics. Like, you cover all the same stuff we love here at the Fretboard Journal, which is why I gravitated towards you. So I think we're like-minded about certain things, at least.
I love, that's where I always say, like, I love all guitars, but I will lose sleep over acoustic guitars. And so that's where, for me, like in the YouTube world, it always, they try to pigeonhole you. Like there's way more electric guitar content, and I always get pushed in that direction, or I have to like play up that part of my guitar collecting. But yeah, most of my channel is me just losing my mind, finding old Martins hidden in the valley or in the mountains of Virginia and West Virginia.
Well, and you probably live in one of the rare places where those still surface kind of uncirculated. Yeah.
Yeah, I had one show up last week. Not a Martin, but I had a 63 Fender Music Master. Yeah. Like, it's a one owner. This guy got it when he was a sophomore in high school. His dad bought it for him. And it's just, yeah, those things are still out there.
That's so cool. I want to get to your YouTube channel. I want to get to Rasmus, which is the reason that I originally reached out to you. I just talked to Rasmus and got a little bit of his story, and now I want you to get your thoughts, because you're how I got turned on to all that. But before we get to all that, you've been buying and selling and horse trading guitars for a really long time, right?
Probably 18 years at this point. Yeah, like my first job, I was washing dishes at a university, and I always hung around this vintage guitar shop. I walked into the guitar shop one day, and the guy who owned the shop had an old D45 hanging on the wall. He's like, "Tell me, what do you know about that?" And I was like, "Oh, well, it's a D45. And I just knew details about it. And he was impressed with that. And he's like, "Well, Jeremy, you want to come work for me?" And I was like, "Yeah." So I went and quit washing dishes that day and then started working in a vintage guitar shop. And, but I'd been buying and selling before that, but it has been just an obsession for coming on 20 years now.
Was this a necessity because you were in a band and you wanted to play a better guitar than you owned, and you went from the paperclip up to the rare Martin, or how did it all work out?
That's a good question. I do not pay enough attention to who plays what guitars or what guitars were used on what records. That stuff's just not as interesting to me. I love how guitars are built. I love how guitars age. I love what they do to families and the stories you hear of a guitar that's, you know, flowed through the life of a family for 50, 60 years. So that's what always stuck out to me, is I started meeting people who had that experience with, you know, the pre-war guitars, you know, where this was grandma's guitar, and then it was my dad's guitar, and now it's my guitar. And I just always have loved that part of guitars.
Yeah, same here. That's why we do the Fretboard Journal. I'm sure your techniques have changed as mediums and social media and all this stuff, but early on, let's go back to 18 years, 20 years, whatever. How were you finding guitars? How were you flipping them?
I was finding guitars we had this thing called the Valley Trader, which was like just a classified newspaper. And I would find old listings, and I would look for certain things. It would be like, old acoustic guitar, and like all three words are spelled wrong, and it's just some West Virginia area code. It's in the middle of nowhere. And I would find them. Okay, my strategy was always like, how do old people sell things?
Sure.
Old people sell things in the classifieds and whiteboards and message boards at grocery stores. And
And if you look back upon all the guitars that have come and gone, what was the greatest deal to date that you've found?
Ooh, the greatest deal I ever found. This is a story I've told before. I was 19. I was going to college, but I was working at a guitar shop, and I found a 61 Gibson Les Paul. It was an SG shape. It was white. It had three PAFs, had a sideways gold tremolo. And the guy wanted $11,000 for it. And I told my dad, I was like, "Dad, I have $5,000 that I could use for this next semester of college. Or you could let me borrow another $6,000 and I will buy this guitar. And I promise you I will make money." And my dad was like, "No way. Stay in college. Don't use that money for this." I was like, "Come on." And I hounded him for about 2 weeks. And he finally was like, "Okay, like, but this is on you. If you lose this, you're going to pay me back with interest." I was like, fine, let's do it. So I got $11,000. I went and I picked up this 61 Gibson Les Paul. And the guy that I was working for at the guitar shop, he took us to the Philly Guitar Show, and we sold it for $27,500. And That's how I paid for most of the rest of college.
I was going to ask, did you just drop out then and there and decide to become a guitar player?
I never had the courage to drop out of college. Okay. I don't know why.
What did you study?
I went to school for special education. Okay. I always thought I was going to be a teacher.
Well, you are to a certain degree now.
It's true. I definitely use a lot of what I learned in college.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, wow. That was a great deal. And did I read somewhere that like you claim or you think you've bought and sold like 3,000 guitars? It's probably more
that
now.
That was a couple of years ago. Yeah, that was a couple of years ago. And then I've never had a faster clip than I've had the last 4 years of doing YouTube full time.
Okay.
I had my assistant recently try and figure it out. Like we've added another 1,000 guitars in the last like 3 years. So, I mean, I've owned so many guitars at this point. Yeah.
And what is the general, let's fast forward. We talked about the old days when there were Valley newspapers and penny savers and stuff like that. These days, if you can divulge any secrets, where are you finding most of these instruments? How long are you holding on to them? And then when do they leave and how do they leave you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I find guitars, well, I think once you gain enough momentum chasing after guitars like this, they kind of find me at this point.
Sure.
I get lots of emails through my website of leads of guitars or messages on Facebook. But specialized Facebook market groups or marketplace groups have been my main place of finding cool guitars the last few years. I still like Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist are still pretty regular places for me to look. And yeah, so then how do guitars, how long do they stay with me? I don't buy guitars as investments. I think that you should have money that will take care of you and your family for the rest of your life, and then you should enjoy guitars, and I don't think you should mix those two. So if I buy a guitar that I know that I'm have a good upside, and if I know that I'm not going to keep it, I turn them pretty quickly, within 3 to 6 months. That's where most of them have come and gone. Every now and then I will have a guitar that lives with me for a long time, several years, and it just falls out of my affections, or I'm into a different style of music and I'm not playing it as much. Or the big one is I find that I have redundancy because I really like the things I like. I've been on this total kick. I love mahogany back and sides guitars. And so all of a sudden I look around, I'm like, I have 12 that are remarkable and I don't need, you know, I don't need all of these guitars.
Wow. So do you play music in the area? Are you gigging?
I'm playing a lot less. So I lived in New Orleans for a while, and that's when I had kind of standing gigs. I'd play 3 or 4 times a month. I have not played like that since I moved back to the Shenandoah Valley. Most of my guitar playing now is in the church. I play once or twice a month in the church. And occasionally I will have jams or play music with other people. But yeah, it's a thing that I think just in the season I am now with, I have 3 little kids.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I'm exhausted by 8 o'clock. I'm not going to rally and go play.
I have one. He's not even that little and I'm always exhausted. So I feel for you.
Yeah.
When you buy a guitar, do you have a formula in your head of like, it has to be 20% available for 20% less than I think I'm going to eventually sell it for? Or do you have, mm-hmm. do you go through those calculations?
I do. I run like very firmly by my intuition, but general rules, I never pay what people are asking. That's just something in my brain is, there's some level of it. Yeah. I think I operate, and this sounds terrible, I operate a bit by win lose. Like I need to know that I'm getting a deal. And so I need to hear someone say like, no, I can't do that. Like, okay, great. We've arrived at the best deal I can get. For me, when I'm looking at buying a guitar, I don't pay retail, and I'm pretty honest. Like I will tell people the pieces of what I'm trying to figure out. I'm like, hey, I don't keep guitars forever. I really love this guitar. I pay in cash. I will buy it today. I kind of trade off like, hey, you're going to get money today. And you're going to trade off, you know, that 10-15%. I don't lowball people. I think it's very morally wrong to take advantage of people, especially when someone tells you so and so died or yeah, lost my job or life is hard.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was worried when you were telling me your greatest guitar find story that it was going to be like some crazy lowball thing, and I was just going to feel pangs of guilt. Oh. But I'm sure that $11,000 that you were able to was a life changer for the person who sold the guitar to you.
It was a pawn shop.
Oh, it was a pawn shop. Okay, well, they have no feelings.
yeah. I very rarely. I've only bought maybe two guitars from pawn shops because it's. It's a business that does not preserve the dignity of their clientele.
No, it does not. And then how are you selling mostly? I know you have a website and you have a guitars for sale along with various other things, which we'll get to. But is that the main channel? Or are you posting on Reverb and Facebook and Craigslist and all of it?
So my first YouTube video that really took off was a video called I'm Quitting Reverb. I have a pretty public and very bad history with Reverb. And it included a 5-year gap where I did not use Reverb at all. I just came back maybe 6 weeks ago and it was kind of amazing. I put 5 guitars up. I sold all 5 for asking price with no issues to really good buyers. So I'm very happy with the most recent iteration of Reverb. That's a large part of why I started doing what I was doing on YouTube was that if I'm going to buy and sell guitars as a living, I'm not going to use Reverb, I have to be able to build up a platform that I can get these guitars into the hands of players. And so over the last couple of years, I've built up my own website and I get pretty good traffic now. And most everything that I sell, it comes in, gets featured on a couple of videos. And then if it's going to go, it goes on the website. And I usually give first access of what I'm selling to my patrons, and I give them a deal like, hey, if you want it, here's a 20% discount. And then there's like a 5-day waiting period before it goes public.
Yeah. I wasn't kidding when I said earlier that, you know, you're using your education skills now because you've got the YouTube channel, you've built up a huge following there. You got the Patreon. You've also got coursework on how to build out a guitar collection. I mean, you've kind of covered the full ecosystem here of, you know, how to get into guitar buying and selling.
I want people to feel empowered to own a collection of guitars that matter. And nothing feels that precious to me, but I've tried to condense things down where it's like, hey, if you want to watch several hundred YouTube videos, you can gather all these pieces and parts, or you can buy this course and it'll walk you through. You can do it over a weekend or a week and it'll walk you through how I think about buying guitars, where to buy them, what they're worth, how to sell them, how to get the most out of them, how to take good pictures, and then how to end up with those 3 or 4 or 5 guitars that really you're going to think about and your family's going to know are special when it's time to figure out what to do with them next.
This is quite an operation. Is this just you? Like when you do these YouTube videos, are you the one hitting record or do you have a team now?
I have come and go. So I live in a college town that has lots of graphic designers and young creatives.
Perfect.
So I've had 2 editors that will do some filming and producing, and then I have an assistant. But for the most part, it's me.
Do you like it like that, or do you need help desperately?
It's a boundaryless life. Like being a YouTube creator is really complicated because you're constantly thinking of what are the 3 things you should know when you're trading your guitar? And I'm like playing with my kids or washing dishes.
Sure.
So I don't like it. I don't like how busy it is all around. I know that if I worked at a job that had a boss that pushed me as hard as I push myself, I would probably have quit by now. Yeah. So trying to find a balance. It's also interesting because I think largely the message I have, people do not like guitar flippers. And so I've had to, like, at first, that was my first kind of push was like, I'll teach you how to flip guitars as a side hustle. And people were not into that.
No, you had to downplay it a little bit. What is your strategy with the YouTube channel? You are a YouTube personality. Is it one a week? Like how much time do those take, and where do you want to find your audience? Like, walk me through your thought process there.
Yeah. It's an ever-changing thing. I started doing YouTube in the Casey Neistat days of like, I'll just do vlog kind of videos. I'll just kind of show off my life. At that point, I was a regional sales manager. I was in South Louisiana. I was going to cool guitar shops. I was like, oh, I can just show this stuff. And then it started being more targeted. I found a crazy guitar. Let's go pick up that guitar and meet the owner and hear their story. And then it grew to, hey, I have too many guitars for my house. I'm going to open a small shop in New Orleans and sell guitars there. So the workflow continues to grow and spin out. And I'm a pretty obsessive, I like doing things well. And so I got really into, as much as I care about the guitar gear, I got into camera gear and production and editing. So it will take as much energy as you will give to it. And then it will ask for more. But the general workflow now, I'm slower now than I have been. I was doing three videos a week or two videos a week in a live show, which was crazy.
Yeah.
And then I started working 32 hours at Hometown Music. I was like, that is unsustainable. I cannot do. So I slowed down a year ago, and then I'm still going to slow down but increase the quality of what I'm doing over the next year. The other large shift is I don't need any more guitars. And so with the YouTube channel, it's hard trying to figure out. People get frustrated when I buy guitars and sell them immediately, but I don't need these guitars. And so I'm trying to make it like, hey, if you want, I'll pass on the good deals, like become a patron. I'll give you first crack at this, and I'll give you like basically just over what I'm paying for it. And some people have taken me up on that, but yeah, so I don't know. It's a bit amorphous. And, I think just the style of YouTube videos has changed so much. It's moved into shorts and reels, into vertical crop, which is so painful for guitar content. Like, yeah. Do you play guitar at an angle? Do I shrink it down and blur out the background? What do I do? How do I get guitars into this short, tiny, weird context?
Do you burn out doing these videos?
Yeah, I think I'm coming out of being really burned out. I took 2 months pretty slow. I'm slowly inching back to like, okay, what does this look like? I think it just needs to ebb and flow. And more videos does not necessarily mean more views. I found like when you push too hard, your retention rate drops off and viewer rate and your subscriber rate drops off. So I've found as I've slowed down and made better stuff, I get more views, I get more shares.
Yeah. It's such an interesting time. Like there's, you know, you go onto YouTube now and everyone's got the big thumbnail. And I know I'm sounding like an old guy when I say this, but like, you know, it's this very jarring thing where you're like, is this sustainable in 10 years? Or is this just going to look like the hood of a NASCAR? And like, I don't know, like, it's got to level out and somehow get a little more artful, I imagine. I don't know.
Yeah. That's the thing I miss most about my own channel. My favorite videos are from 2020 to, or like 2020, 2021, when it was just okay. So on YouTube, if you were a YouTuber, if you said COVID, like, see, I couldn't talk about what was happening in the world.
Okay.
But I was feeling, you know, very claustrophobic and locked in. So I would do these like much more cinematic, much more poetic, really beautiful shots as I'm going to pick up a guitar, and I'll show, you know, in really cool shots with drones, how I'm picking up guitars from people and how I'm selling guitars. And I wanted it to be much more beautiful and poetic. What has really bummed me out is over the last couple of years where I just get stuck in a studio doing promoted content. And it doesn't feel as creative. That's a really complicated part of the YouTube algorithm, or just how this content changes over time.
Yeah, walk us through. I swear I'm not being, I mean, I know a little bit of this world, but I'm kind of naive about a lot of it. So sponsored posts, sponsored content, is that 50% of your video output, more, less?
It ebbs and flows. It's changed over the years. It was probably about, at the highest, it was about 50%. And that would be Sweetwater was put, was Sweetwater had lots of money during the big boom in 21 and 22 for sponsored content. And so they would say, hey, do something fun. We're going to send you this guitar and this preamp and these pedals and all that stuff. And yeah, that those were fun, but it's hard to come up with the creative. And I think by default, it eventually just becomes basically a promotion or an advertisement for things. Yeah. And it's interesting. I have a video where I talk about the problem with gear reviews and what I find being Southern is that when you get a thing that comes in the mail and it's wrapped up and there's a little bag of candy in there and you open it up and you're like, this is a present. This is so fun. And the rudest thing you could do with a present is say anything bad about it or look too closely at it. And so I realized, I'm like, oh man, this is not a present. Yeah. I'm working really hard for this. And they are going to benefit really financially from this. And so it is really important to people who are going to spend their own money buying these things that I tell the truth and I say what I don't like about this. And I talk about this thing really honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I've seen that even just in really recent history in the last month or so where there's sort of a new product release and there's this mad dash and your YouTube feed is flooded with six people glowing about it.
Yeah.
And then 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, the reality sets in and somebody finally puts a little bit more critical eye on the product at hand. And people just kind of ignore that first wave of videos. But I'm sure those videos probably turned a bunch of people onto buying that product that ended up being not the greatest.
Yeah. I was in several of the Fender releases. I was in the American Pro 2 Stratocaster. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my best performing videos to that point. That was a kind of a generation shift in how I was making content. And that video put me onto the level where people were start talking about other YouTubers. And that's the first time other YouTubers started reaching out to me to talk. But then you roll out other, that was such a well done launch that then they kept doing the same strategy of like, 25 YouTubers get this guitar. We all post videos on the same day.
Yep.
And by the time it got to the American, to the Fender American Jazzmaster Acoustasonic, that's the one that people really lost their minds. And I got so many emails and messages just saying like, you're a corporate shill. I remember when you had a soul.
Well, I mean, without going into total details, you've got like 50,000 YouTube followers. You've got these big brands sometimes reaching out to you. Do you make more money off the YouTube revenue, the ad revenue, or the sponsors? Or is it kind of split down the middle?
YouTube revenue is still, I have a higher CPM. I get paid more per 1,000 videos.
Okay.
Even because I have a very disproportionate, I get a lot more views than I have subscribers. I think I only have like 11% of my viewers, 11% of my monthly views are subscribed. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure.
Like, yeah, like eight. Yeah, it's insane to me how many people watch my channel. Because I think I'm also into guitars and the kind of content that older players are into. And so it's like people that aren't logged into Google or, you know, they're not going to give their information. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm just into older acoustic guitars and yeah. So
you're not encouraging enough people to smash the subscribe button is what you're telling me.
That's yeah. I mean, it is true. It's the thing that I say. It also is hard. And this is a quick other aside about being a YouTuber. There's a very strange thing that happens psychologically when, I mean, the first time you record yourself on camera? Like, do you remember the first time you saw yourself on
camera?
That's
horrible. It's a horrible experience. It's why I'm not a YouTuber.
Yeah. And then, but then you watch that video and then you're like, okay, well, I can chop out some parts and I can make myself sound like I know what I'm talking about. And then you do that and then you put it out. And then people talk about how you did on that video and you read those comments and then you're like, okay, well, I'm going to make another video. And then you rinse and repeat 500 times. You get to a version of yourself psychologically where you are performing, you're doing a character of yourself, or you're like reproducing a performance that you've seen and tweaked and modified your language patterns and modified your gestures. And you've gotten to where your brain's 3 seconds ahead of what you're actually thinking. Or what you're actually saying at the moment. And it becomes very strange. And I can tell, especially when you're doing content out in public with people that actually know you as a person.
Oh yeah.
They all say the same thing. They're like, whoa, like you go into YouTube mode. But yeah, it's a strange thing making YouTube videos.
I bet. I like YouTube mode.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one of the cool things about your channel and one of the reasons I'm talking to you is because you also, and probably why you're found by people who maybe haven't subscribed yet, is you take chances and do videos on unlikely things. It's not just the new Fender release. You go find a crazy Takamine that is, you know, ready to explode, and you spend all the time that you would to, you know, promote a corporation's product to just be like, hey, this thing is almost worthless. Let's see what I can do with it. Here's why I bought it in the first place.
Yeah. I love those. I found a Laprinzi this past summer.
Wow.
And it's a guitar that my guitar heroes loved.
Yeah.
Like all the guys that taught me what to care about in acoustic guitars, they loved Laprinzis. So as soon as I found one, I bought one. And yeah, that video did not get many views, but I just thought it was so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So, you know, we've been talking about social media and YouTube and you know, how to promote and buy and sell guitars these days in 2024. But you also just briefly mentioned that you are now, at least part-time, working for an old-school brick-and-mortar guitar shop. What is your strategy? I'm assuming they're not idiots. They want you to help sell guitars or market the store. Don't have you cleaning the bathrooms.
I do that too. I swept all the floors this morning.
So what's your strategy there? This is a store that I, you know, it's not a Gruen or Rudy's. It's not one of these like famous iconic stores. It's a local store that I'm sure will be heard about in the future. But what are you doing? Tell me what your strategy is there.
Our strategy is really simple. We want people to find guitars that they want to grow old with. And our strategy is based on the premise that people do business with people. Every town, lots of old towns used to have the guy that knew how to fix a buzzy guitar. And you could just go and ask them questions and they would just have the answers. I think for a lot of us, as small guitar shops have gone away and big guitar shops have taken over, there's less of that like dispersed wisdom on guitar, how to live with guitars, how to be a musical creative person your whole life in a small town. So for us, we immediately pumped up. We want to do repairs really well because guitars need lots of love and TLC, especially we get four distinct seasons. And so we get guitars drying out and getting really buzzy and then guitars getting spongy and high action. So the other thing we're going to really institute, I think the strongest case for the small guitar shop, right, its biggest strength is the buy, sell, trade business model. And it's nothing new, but it is a thing that it does so much for just helping cultivate and create some currency and movement in a local guitar scene. So for us, helping beginners get into guitars, and then as those high school kids that we help talk them into an Alvarez, you know, 8030 or like these kind of entry level guitars, a year later, we can help them trade up and get into an Eastman or whatever they're aimed for next. And for us, it's about our business has to preserve the dignity of people that are trying to become better at guitar. So for us, it's just making sure that we're not lowballing them. We're giving them options. And then we're also giving them exposure to cool and aspirational guitars. And we want to add those in thoughtfully and in a way that never makes someone feel like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to spend $8,000 on a guitar. Like, get that away. But we want to have cool stuff and to see, hey, this is a lifelong thing you could be into.
That's cool and fascinating. And you didn't once mention an internet strategy. So is thinking locally really kind of how you guys are framing it?
So we certainly, yeah. So we're certainly like, that's our ground base, is that we want like that. We want it to be the other thing where I was very particular. I was like, hey, we are going to have couches and a seating area in the actual guitar shop.
Mm-hmm. Huge.
And many times people have been like, well, we could actually put more guitars in here. If I'm like, yeah, we could, but I want places for people to sit and play and get to know each other. So we're kind of taking the Starbucks strategy of being a third place. You got work, you got home, you now have this third place. You can sit and meet and catch up with friends. And so we now we have the pals, like the old guys that come and hang around, and we have people that come by on lunch break. For that with the buy sell trade, if there's new used stuff around and people can come and hang out, you will get more people through the door and building kind of a stronger culture around your shop. So we certainly do have an online strategy. We have an e-com website. We're pretty we're very active on social media, trying to figure out how to grow Hometown Music's social media following without just being like, this is the shop Jeremy the Shepherd works at, has been a big challenge. But it's been really fun because I get to play producer and I get to just, I have a camera and I'm going to have you do stuff. I'll coach you through what to do, but it's not going to be me on the camera.
That's really cool. What's your official title there?
I'm the business development manager.
Business. That's great. Yeah, it was, I knew we were like-minded, but I've used that third place analogy to so many people. I think I've probably even written about it on our Patreon because I love guitars. I have a collection, not like the one in your background, but I've spent most of my adult life writing about luthiers and guitars and guitar culture and publishing a magazine around it. And I'll go into some stores and, you know, sometimes they have that feng shui, sometimes they don't. But if I don't feel like I can just go sit in a corner and kind of be left alone or strike up a conversation, if I'm feeling that way, I hate the store where you walk in and the clerk is just staring at you like, what are you looking for? And it's like, I'm not sure I'm looking for anything. I just wanted to come and see a guitar store.
Oh, the please ask to play guitars, and they have the little plastic tag. Yeah.
They're going to watch you as you fumble your way through. It's the worst.
Yeah.
Are you doing anything?
Yeah, what gets me is when they stop you and look at your belt and waist.
Oh, yeah.
He's hanging. Or are you no pocket knives?
I know. Are you doing much with events, bringing people? Do you do jams or open mics or anything in the store just to kind of bring everybody in at once?
We've done different events throughout the past year. There's several big music festivals that have academies that are training kids, mostly middle school and elementary school age kids in roots music. Mm-hmm. So we've done events in partnership with them. And we've had open jams. We have been letting guitar brands as they're coming through and they have an artist rep or whoever's coming through. So we just did an event with Yamaha a couple weeks ago, and they brought some of the new acoustics that they're doing.
Amazing.
I really, really like the new Yamaha acoustics.
They're great. I'm looking at one right here.
We just sold one in the shop, and it was one that in the back of my mind, I was like, I should buy that one. I like that one. And then it sold yesterday.
Yeah. That's cool. And where do you see this going? What's your dream for this store?
My dream for this store, so I've wanted to really make sure that we have the basics. Like, I want to make sure that it is a guitar shop that is all the things we were talking about, that people feel comfortable and safe and excited. They feel believed in when they come in. So that's where, like, before we like hype it up and like do a huge YouTube channel, I want to make sure that this place really is cool. And so I've encouraged our guys, like, hey, you're on tour next week. Okay, please go to Russo's. Go check out Russo's in Philly while you're there. Or, like, you know, one of the guys was in he was in California, and I was like, dude, you have to go to Griffin. It is the greatest shop. And so I'm having our guys go to these like incredible aspirational guitar shops. And then when they come back, they're like, I get it. I get why you know, had some strong opinions about where we put the Hosa cable wall. Like, it has to be like, we want it to be fun and cool. So, like, dream situation for us is that we become a destination guitar shop, mm-hmm. because we have the Shenandoah National Park on one side, and then we have the George Washington National Forest on the other side. We're in the Shenandoah Valley. It looks like the Shire here. And so for us, like, we want people to come on vacation, and it happened. We had so many people that follow me on YouTube come through last year and just spend a weekend at an Airbnb and then come and hang out at the shop. They get to tour. So we partner with Showalter Guitars. He's an amazing builder, maybe 10 minutes from here.
Okay.
And he uses all woods from the Shenandoah Valley.
Nice.
We have Hudson Dalton, is about 30 minutes the other way. There are so many great guitar builders. Yeah,
you're in the thick of it. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Did you go to NAMM this year?
I didn't. I don't know. I'm such a used guitar guy,
yeah.
Which is funny because I work at a new guitar shop. But NAMM has never been that interesting to me. Can I say that?
You can say that. I mean, it's a complicated thing. I even hate bringing it up, but I always ask people in the industry. But it's, you know, you don't hear electronics and home theater lovers reminisce about this great CES of 2010 or whatever. Like, it's just such a weird thing that guitarists are very passionate about, even though only like 1% of guitarists ever go to it.
Yeah. But it also seems like it's a different thing now than it used to be, especially for small guitar shops. It used to be you had to go to NAMM because there were deals that made your business profitable. That only happened when you were there.
A lot of stores, including some famous ones, did not go. Obviously, a lot of big brands were not there. There were more than there were last year. But yeah, it's an evolving thing because it's not what it used to be. Most of these releases from the brands that are showcased there are announced weeks prior. And it's not like you hear anything at NAMM. Your ears are messed up from the minute you walk in. And yes, you can hear a nice loud amplifier, but even going into a soundproof room, you're really not going to have a good sense of, like, is this a great guitar or just a good guitar? And so, you have a lot of folks from YouTube and social media roaming around and loving it because they're gathering months worth of content.
Yeah.
But from a dealer perspective and from a brand perspective, I'm not sure they've figured out the new version that works for everybody.
Yeah.
I also know some brands that, you know, are making great products and haven't met all of their future dealers yet. And they had a resoundingly great experience because they stood out and they're making great product. But if you're building a guitar and you're perfectly happy with the 50 dealers you have or whatever, I don't know why you'd buy a $10,000 booth. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, but then you're like, well, the booth is probably one of the cheap parts of the whole thing.
Totally.
I got to get there. I got to insure it. I got to get back and forth each day. Man. Yeah. That's what, to me, it's never been like, I'm not the cheapest. I could do it just as a solo coming from the exact opposite side of the country. Like, it's about a $3,000 commitment for me.
For sure.
And that's where I'm like, I'm not going to make $3,000 worth of YouTube videos coming out of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other people would that have a different channel that's built on new guitars and spending the money. And that's just not my style.
Yeah. I mean, it's very much, I mean, and everybody's been saying this for over a decade, you know, it's a relationship building place and you really are going to network. Is it the best place to network with your buddies from the industry? I'm not for me. I'm too introverted. Yeah. Like I'd rather meet them one-on-one and fly to Austin and see the Collings crew or whatever. Like I don't want to talk to them for 30 seconds on a trade show floor, but that's me.
Yeah, I get that.
The reason I called you, we've been talking for a while. The reason I called you is because you didn't turn me on to buying a guitar, but you turned me on to interviewing somebody about a guitar. Mm. And that was our friend, our mutual friend now, Rasmus.
Rasmus is amazing. He's so talented and he's so kind. And he's just become such a dear friend over the last couple of years.
So I feel like for the last 35, 40 minutes, I've established that you are not a moron when it comes to guitars. You know a thing or two. You've got a great BS filter. You call it like you see it. I feel like we've established all that. So for you to spotlight on your Instagram page a 17-year-old acoustic guitar builder, and this totally rocks my world. I've already mentioned this in the intro to this podcast, but for someone at the age of 17 in high school to take the time and amass the tools to learn how to properly build even one guitar, but then a few, and then have one so good that someone like yourself is like, this is actually a really great guitar. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
So how did you guys meet?
I don't remember totally. I know he interacted. So in 2020, I started doing a live show. So I started really committing to like each week, I'm just going to answer questions. And he started showing up in the chat and he would ask questions. Hey, is forward shifted bracing really a critical component to building a Martin style dreadnought? And I would answer questions like that. And then afterwards he would ask me, he would send me messages on Instagram, and then somehow we got connected on WhatsApp. And he was like, oh, I want to send you pictures of a guitar I'm building. And he was building basically a D28, but it's Paduke back and sides. And I think this is terrible. I forget the details of his first guitar. But he was asking me questions about bridge placement and how much does a pick guard actually reduce the volume of a guitar and should I do this finish or if I did a sunburst. And we just quickly connected about what the world's best acoustic guitars are. And so I'm not a builder. I'm not a luthier. I've built a couple guitars, but I have loved these things and really paid attention forever. And so during that time, he started asking me questions about, hey, if you would order a custom guitar, what would you get? And it was just like completely hypothetical. I was like, oh, I would do a 00. I would do kind of a 30s Martin 00018 with a slot headstock and a sunburst and then like a really big neck. And maybe 2 months in, he was like, hey, I've got an idea. And he started sending me pictures of like a neck blank and a back and side set. And he was like, hey, if you want, would you be interested in buying this guitar if I built it for you? And I was like, absolutely. And I never asked him what the price would be. I was just like, absolutely. Like I'm up for, if I can help anybody become a better guitar builder, I'm in. And so I'm looking over here cause it's just over here. And yeah, now you're going to have to do some video. But so he made this guitar for me. And so eventually he asked me like, what are your dream specs? And I said, well, I'd like kind of a tight grain, older European kind of spruce top. I would like really pretty mahogany back and sides. I want a slot headstock. I want a big dark sunburst. I love pyramid bridges. And then Otis Taylor, his model, has this same thing where it jumps off. Is it the 16th fret? 13, 14, 15. So the 15th fret, it drops off. And so this guitar slowly came together over about a year and a half. And I had another friend, one of my patrons, flew over right when it was done. He just happened to be in in Rotterdam, and he and Rasmus had become friends through the chat on my on Guitar Hunter Live. And so they got together, and then my friend Daniel was like, look what I played. And so he played the guitar, and that's when Daniel was the first one to tell me, dude, this thing is a killer. Like, it is remarkable. And so, yeah, to tie it all together, my nickname from high school is Jimmy Sheep. Yep. And so, so Rasmus put a sheep on the headstock. At first he did it where it was going to be a shepherd staff since my last name's Shepherd, but I felt a little on the nose.
Incredible. And just for reference, because I brought this up, he started peppering you with questions about guitar building when he was like 14, 15? 14.
Yeah. 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 And so it's funny over the years, he and I will just text back and forth. He'll ask me questions and he'll FaceTime me and show me things he's working on. And it's just while I'm living life. And so like, I keep a pretty strong separation between like my family life and work life. But Rasmus has literally like my kids know his name and know his face, and they'll talk to him and tell him stories when they see him. And it's, a whole relational bond has happened just because of this guitar and in the process of this guitar coming to life. And it's amazing. Now, with that said, like it plays really well. It's a really agile guitar and it's incredibly resonant. It's not perfect. Like I threw so much at him. That's the thing is I never thought he would actually build this guitar. I was like, no, this is like just if I would order an $8,000, you know, $6,000 guitar, this is what I would hope for.
Sure.
But he nailed it.
It's so cool. And obviously somebody who has the self-starter ingenuity, whatever you want to call it, to build a guitar mm-hmm. and reach out to strangers across the pond at that young age. I mean, he could probably do anything he wants career-wise, but it'll be really interesting to see where he goes with guitars if that's where he goes.
I think so too. And that's what I've told him. I'm like, I will help you however I can help you. And so I think in a year or two, I would love to get him. This is a dream would be to get him working at Boucher Guitars. Because there are a couple other guys that are from Amsterdam and from the Netherlands that work for Boucher.
Okay. Cool. Well, thank you for turning me on to Rasmus. I mean, I'm always scrolling, looking for interesting stories, and I certainly found one thanks to you.
Yeah, I love this guitar. It's so exciting. And yeah, I'll send you more pictures of it as well.
Yeah, congrats on the guitar. Congrats on everything else. You're kicking ass. I love your channel.
Thank you. I can't believe that this is how I get to spend my time. It's so fun.
It's awesome. Jeremy, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that was my chat with Jeremy. Again, thank you all for tuning into the podcast. Leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts if you haven't yet. It helps others find the show. We are going to be posting some of these shows as videos soon, so stay tuned for that. We have a ton of great content in the interim on our YouTube channel. Go follow us, Fretboard Journal. And as always, if you want to join us, if you want to support us, go to fretboardjournal.com and click on that subscribe button. I would love to blow your minds when you see the Fretboard Journal for the first time. If you haven't yet, it's truly a sight to behold.